Hello everyone and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
Together we are tackling this disease, and I want to reassure you that if we remain united and resolute, then we will overcome it.
A rare prime-time address from Britain's Queen Elizabeth as the Prime Minister Boris Johnson languishes in hospital with coronavirus. Physician and author Siddhartha Mukherjee lays out the toll of this disease as it sweeps across the world. Then, how did Iran become the Middle Eastern epicenter for this virus? My exclusive interview with Vice President Mohammad Nahavandian. And
the countries that have managed the crisis of the pandemic most successfully have been Asia's democracies.
Author Parag Khanna on how coronavirus has connected the whole world, providing a playbook on how to survive it. And finally,
when you can't do what you do, you do what you can.
Singer Jon Bon Jovi and his fans come together to create a song for these trying times. Welcome to the programme, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour, working from home in London, where the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson becomes the first major world leader to be hospitalised for coronavirus, more than a week after he was infected and tested positive. This as Queen Elizabeth urged Britons to stay strong and stay home. Take a listen.
I hope in the years to come, everyone will be able to take pride in how they responded to this challenge. And those who come after us will say the Britons of this generation were as strong as any.
While a fierce debate rages over whether Johnson should hand over control while he's out, he tweets that he's still running things, saying, "I'm in good spirits and keeping in touch with my team." While in the United States, the Surgeon General warns Americans to brace for the hardest, saddest week ahead, a Pearl Harbor or 9/11 time. The government's top expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, says there will be more cases and more deaths in the coming days before any better news ahead.
Unfortunately, if you look at the projection of the curves, of the kinetics of the curves, we're going to continue to see an escalation. Also, we should hope that within a week, maybe a little bit more, we'll start to see a flattening out of the curve and coming down.
In fact, Spain and Italy, which have been ravaged by the virus, are now seeing the rate of new infections fall. Physician Siddhartha Mukherjee studies the progress of the virus, both across the world and within individual patients. His book, The Gene, An Intimate History, is now the basis of a timely new film and documentary on PBS. It's done alongside Ken Burns. And he is joining me now from New York. Siddhartha Mukherjee, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I just want to start by asking you, just to sort of prognosis, if you can, what you think of the fact that after 10 days, the British Prime Minister has had to be hospitalized. And obviously, the government is playing it down for the most part. Nonetheless, ill enough to have to go to the hospital, and we understand have oxygen on his way to the hospital. How do you assess his condition? And I know it's remote.
Well, I think this is the typical progress of the disease. I mean, I think what we've learned from many, many patients, the ones that do get sick, the first 5 or 6 or 7 days are, you know, flus and chills. And then in some patients, it, you know, day 7, 8, 9, and 10 are the worst. You require oxygen. And, you know, there's a turning point around day 9 and day 10 when you can, really make the turn for the worst or slowly recover. So I can't make a prognosis in his particular case. I hope he recovers. But this is very much a typical course of the disease in some patients.
So what do you see now? Because even Dr. Fauci says, you know, trying to figure out the pathogenesis of this virus is quite difficult. Who does it affect? How? Asymptomatic or not? Et cetera, et cetera. Young people, old people. Can you draw any, at least interim conclusions about what it is this enemy is?
Well, first of all, most people don't even, you know, we need to know the language of epidemiology, but this is a very unusual virus, and it has two properties. It has two properties that make it particularly virulent. Number one is that it seems as if the so-called R0 of the virus, in other words, how many people can one person infect, the contagiousness, some measure of contagiousness, is quite large. It's less than measles, but it's quite large. And so the virus, therefore, can spread exponentially if you don't have appropriate measures. That's one. I'm an oncologist, but I was trained as a virologist to start with. The second thing, which is very, very unusual and concerning, is that completely asymptomatic people seem to be able to carry the virus and spread the virus. And it's the confluence of these two factors that makes it a particular challenge. You don't know if the person sitting next to you on the bus is infected and carrying the virus, or whether they, you know, whether they're already immune, or whether they're perfectly fine.
Is that the worst thing that sort of worries you? Is that the most complicating factor, do you think? I mean, the fact that you just don't know who might have it or who might not on your daily, you know, daily rambles, daily life.
Well, that and the fact that you cannot predict which people will take a turn for the worse and which people will not, because it seems as if you took 100 people, you know, even within the same age group, even in the same age bracket, some people seem to have a bad flu and recover. Some people are asymptomatic, and some people, you know, take a terrible turn for the worse and unfortunately are looking death in the eye. I think the key things that will happen in the next few weeks is figuring those parameters out. I am a strong believer that we should first protect the medical personnel with the best possible equipment that we can give them, including N95 respirators, gloves, gowns, and face shields, because they are the ones getting exposed to the highest amount of virus and the highest amount of viral load. But I'm also a believer, and I've been a believer right from the start, that along with social distancing and hand washing and hand hygiene and quarantine and isolation, that people on the street should be wearing masks. They can be wearing, I have been proposing that the government distribute free masks, but right now people are just making them by themselves.
Yeah, and I have to say, even from Dr. Fauci and others and from the president, there's a lot of sort of conflicting information about masks. But can I ask you also about the idea of treatments and well, vaccines is down the road, but treatments. We know that the FDA has given companies leeway to just put, for instance, antibody tests on the market. We know that President Trump and his supporters keep talking about chloroquine. How effective or dangerous is this kind of, I don't know, rush to try to provide a solution when there hasn't been one that's been tested?
Well, I mean, I think the correct way to do this is to test it in the appropriate trials, and that's going on right now. So really what we're doing is buying ourselves time, and that's why I think it's very important to reduce the burden on the medical establishment. The way these drugs will come about, as far as I know in terms of drug development, is there'll be three waves. The easiest drugs to get into human beings are drugs that are already that have already been tested on humans but can be so-called repurposed for this virus. There are drugs like remdesivir is one example of them from Gilead, inhibitors of or killers of viral replication. Those would be the first. Those have been already in humans. Those would be the first. And I'm extremely hopeful, and I hope against hope, that one of them will be able to restrict the disease. It may not be the panacea, but it may be able to restrict the disease. Hydroxychloroquine may work in conjunction with them, but by itself, it's an extraordinarily weak agent, and the data for it is extraordinarily weak. So the second set, so that's the first set. We will have results of that by late April. And that will really, once we have a real medicine, it will change the face of this pandemic. Number two will be passive antibodies. Mm-hmm. We know that transfer of antibodies from people who have already had the virus to people who are sick helps. We know that from a small trial. It's not a great big trial, it's a small trial. So therefore, we should be able to make passive antibodies, man-made antibodies, in bioreactors that allow us to get resistance or to fight the virus. Those trials will happen in probably June or July. That's the soonest we can make them. And vaccines, as you said, are down the road. There, we're looking at 12 months at least, 12 to 18 months.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Yes, indeed. Can I ask you, as a physician, of course, you're in New York, which is the worst hit in the United States. But as a physician, what do you make of the stories we're hearing in the United States of physicians being essentially a couple anyway, fired for blowing a whistle? You know what happened to the captain on the USS Theodore Roosevelt. And in Russia, it's, you know, just like what happened in Wuhan. How is it conscionable and ethical to fire medical professionals who are just doing their duty of do no harm and trying to alert the powers that be that they need help in order to be able to protect themselves and their patients?
It's totally unconscionable, Christiane. I mean, you know, it is like sending soldiers into battle without armor. It is like sending people into a radioactive field without protection. And then blaming them for saying, you know, that we have no protection. We have been begging. The pandemic has laid bare the idea that this administration was unprepared and has remained unprepared for protecting their most valuable workers, the physicians. And now they're asking us to do our duty while not providing us with the equipment that we need to do it. So once again, it is unconscionable. We need to buy ourselves time. We need to buy, as medical professionals, we need to buy ourselves time so that the first drugs can be tested and brought to human beings. But it is totally unconscionable.
So can I ask you, because the Washington Post published a huge investigation over the weekend that said that the U.S., the Trump administration, wasted 70 days between hearing about it and actually treating it seriously. And, you know, that this time was wasted. What do you think could have been done and should have been done in those 70 days that may have changed the face of what the United States is going through right now?
Well, 1,000 things could have been done. The medical professional, the medical equipment could have been stocked and stacked. If we had adequate warning about the fact that this would sweep through the United States, we would have readied ourselves for clinical trials. We would have readied ourselves with ventilators, with masks, with gowns. More importantly, we would have warned the public. We would have started social distancing earlier. And as I said, I'm a believer in masks. We would have masked the public, and we would have told people, we would have, you know, in many places, schools would have closed earlier because children can be particularly asymptomatic carriers of the virus. So a range of things could have been done in those 70 days. This is an exponential problem. Every day that we lose against the virus exponentially increases in the population. So a vast number of things could have been done. There will be an autopsy. We will perform an autopsy and we will find the places to blame. But this is not the moment to do that.
Right, exactly. So what it is the moment to do is take a step forward to warn people. So do you think the president of the United States should get up on the podium and tell the remaining 8 states or so that do not have lockdown orders to do it immediately, to tell his base, who are apparently evangelical Christians and others, to stop going to mega churches and stop spreading this and stop endangering themselves? Do you think he should be doing that from the podium of the White House?
Absolutely. And he should be doing that while wearing a mask.
Indeed. Let me ask you a final question. Your documentary, it couldn't be more timely. The book you wrote a while ago, The Gene and Intimate History, co-produced by the great Ken Burns. What do you think that, you know, what you've discovered there with the genes and how the public versus private, I mean, there's so many aspects to it, but in terms of trying to find the answers, could help. I know it's not about COVID, but could help in this kind of issue and in a future pandemic.
Well, there are many things. Every way that we're arming ourselves against this virus depends on the last 100 years of genetics. We talked about making antibodies, making drugs. the swab that is used, this oral swab that's used to detect whether, you know, whether you have a virus or not, based on genetic tests. You know, the public doesn't, most of the public doesn't even know what a virus is. A virus is a piece of genetic material packaged in a coat, which goes and infects cells. We've been using viruses to make genetically engineered products for decades. So if you want to learn about the language, and if you want to participate in this debate, if you want to learn what a gene is, what a virus is, how viruses replicate, you need to understand the history, you need to understand the vocabulary, and I hope the film educates the public about not just this pandemic, but future pandemics as well.
Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee, thank you so much for joining us. And the program will be on PBS starting tomorrow and also the following Tuesday. So, as the pandemic infects more than 1.2 million people worldwide, with almost 70,000 dead now, some countries say they are ready to ease their lockdowns. Austria, for example, plans to reopen non-essential businesses next week after seeing a drop in new infections. And Iran, hit particularly hard with more than 60,000 cases and almost 4,000 dead, according to the health ministry, also plans to ease work restrictions soon. Iran is desperate to revive its economy, battered by punishing U.S. sanctions. Now, Mohammad Nahavandian is Iran's vice president for economic affairs, and he's joining me exclusively from Tehran. Mr. Nahavandian, welcome to the program. I see you are, in fact, joining us from home. If you're still at home and at lockdown, why do you think it's the moment for Iran to start, you know, potentially relaxing these stay-at-home orders and start to open up businesses and work?
Thank you, Christiane. Actually, this is the third stage of the social distancing policy in Iran. As you know, Nowruz is a time for Iranians to travel around the country. When the government started informing people and asking them not to travel, it was hard for Iranians to just do that. But the statistics showed us that more than 70% of people voluntarily decided not to travel. Because of that, the second phase had the mandate from people to make it stricter and have some controls on the cities for people not to travel outside their state. And now, if you look at the statistics from our health ministry today and yesterday, we can see a declining trend in many provinces in the country. So the third stage is called smart social distancing. Gradually, some necessary businesses and offices are opening up, but remaining at home is still the slogan. One third of the people will stay at home. People from the government offices and unnecessary businesses still will be closed.
Can I ask you how the sanctions have affected Iran? Because there are very punishing sanctions by the United States, and the rest of the world abides by the U.S. sanctions. They don't want to cross the United States. So, are you having difficulty getting medical and humanitarian supplies?
Actually, that is the case. In Iran, in fight against the coronavirus, the difficulty is double because of the transaction cost. Despite the rhetoric that food and medicine is not subject to sanctions. But as you know, trade has two ways. If you want to pay for the goods that you import, you have to use the financial institutions, and all the banks and financial institutions have been subject to the blackmailing by United States government. So in reality, provision of medical supplies has been very difficult and very costly. And at the time that...
Now...
Yes.
Sorry to interrupt, but as you know, certainly publicly, the United States government has said that they're prepared to send a package of aid. But the Supreme Leader, your leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, has said no. And he's talked about this being a conspiracy, the virus, by the United States. How do you answer that? And why would you not accept aid from the U.S. when you obviously desperately need it?
You know, your deeds has to confirm your words. You cannot have it both ways. You cannot prevent access to medical supplies and medicine and food, and at the same time you say that we are ready to assist. Before assistance is the step of taking away all of the obstacles that they have put in our ordinary trade, whether it be food and medical supplies or any other trade. So I think the first step is not sending a little small package of medicine, is to take away, to lift the sanctions on food and medical supplies.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you this? Because for the first time in, well, since 1962, Iran has applied for an IMF loan of $5 billion. As I say, it's the first time in all these decades. And the United States apparently has to approve or veto it. It's part of the executive committee of the IMF. Are you getting this loan? Have you received the approval or not?
As you may know, in IMF, we do not have any veto power for any country. And actually, it's a policy of IMF for even-handedness in appraisal and approval of requests. And what Iran has requested for is RFI, Rapid Financial Instrument, which is an automatic instrument that governments countries can use when they are in need of some financing. Iran has been a founding member of IMF with very good record, and it is expected from this international body to do what is expected to do. That request is now in due process. Many countries have expressed their support for this. And at the time of a pandemic, it is very important to realize that if you do not confine and contain the virus in one part of the world, actually, you are helping to spread that virus in other parts of the world. So it is not a local issue. It's a global issue. The reality is now we are observing the dark side of globalization. The problem is global, but we do not have global solution. Now is the time of cooperation, not to start new quarrels and fight against access of one nation to medical supplies. We are all in same boat, as they say.
Mm-hmm. Well, to your point, a group of 24 senior American diplomats, including Madeleine Albright and the former Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel and others, William Cohen, have asked President Trump to potentially save hundreds of thousands of lives across the Middle East, across your whole region, by easing medical and humanitarian pressures and sanctions on you, on Iran. But I want to ask you this, because your government's handling of this crisis has come under fierce criticism from the world and from inside as well. You say there's somewhere in the region of 4,000 dead. That's the official figure. But the opposition, as you know, believes that there's about 12,500 dead in just about every province, some 300 or so provinces or 230 provinces around Iran. How can people trust what the government says about the actual facts and figures, given, of course, and I'm sorry to hark all the way back, but the really dreadful issue after the downing of the Ukrainian airliner, where there was lies and cover-up and dissimulation for days and days?
I think if you go to cyberspace in virtual world, everything is under doubt. Even the statistics from U.S. is being doubted on. What our health ministry has been doing during all these 45 days has been informing according to the confirmed cases. And as the testing capability grew, and that is a very important part of what you just mentioned, because of the difficulty in access to testing packs, we did not have all the cases confirmed. And now we are having more information, and the screening theme that our health ministry started and has been praised by WHO, now more than 60 million people in the country have been screened. So our information is growing nationwide. The data shows that the peak in some of the provinces has been passed, and now we are on the de-escalating part of the curve. We are hopeful that as the cooperation of people, which was shown in the first phase, continues, we will be able to control. And the number of facilities in Iran proved that it has been sufficient to respond to all the cases who were in critical condition. We did not have any cases of a patient coming to a hospital and not being able to be treated there. And we are proud
of that. So let me ask you, because we're running out of some time, but I need to ask you, because I'm a member of the Committee to Protect Journalists, and others are telling, you know, journalists, activists, and other U.S.-based reports that Iranian journalists and editors have been saying that, you know, they were under a lot of pressure by the government, by the judiciary, by the health authorities, not to report the death figures. Why would that be the case when you have to have total transparency in order to be able to fight this kind of a plague? Why would you try to hide it? Why would the government try to hide it?
I can assure you that the policy of President Rouhani's administration is full transparency on this. We do not deal with the life of people, and the policy shows that the life of people is as important for us as the economic life of the people. The policy which was designed for that strengthened the budget for our health ministry. That is why we are in acceptable situation now compared to some other countries, even in Europe, even in the United States. We are deploring the fact that some of the news that we are hearing here is very sad. Now in Iran, we think that we are in control. The number of infected people, the number of patients has passed that increasing level, but we have to be very prudent. The restrictions are still in place. We hope that if we can confine in the new provinces, as it has been confined in the provinces which started with, we'll pass this stage.
All right. Vice President Mohammad Nahavandian, thank you for joining us from Tehran tonight.
Thank you
now,
very much.
China, which is the original epicenter of this virus, also appears to be cautiously opening up again. Authorities, however, are warning that the risk of coronavirus remains high. Parag Khanna is the best-selling author of The Future is Asian, and he's been studying the spread across the continent. He talks to our Hari Srinivasan from his home in Singapore about the lessons the United States can learn from China and whether this pandemic will have a lasting impact on the global or world order?
Parag, what's interesting is that we have been focused on China, but there have been very different outcomes from different Asian countries over the past couple of months.
It's a great place to start the question. You know, let's just step back for a second and remind ourselves that for the last 10, 15 years, whenever people say Asia, they think China, as if the whole region is one large authoritarian bloc. And it's not. And the countries that have managed the crisis of the pandemic most successfully have been Asia's democracies. I'm excluding, of course, India, the largest democracy in the world, and certainly that of Asia, because we don't really know about the spread of the virus there, though they have at least managed to impose some kind of a lockdown. But let's look at the gold standard democracies of Asia, which are indeed Japan, Taiwan, South Korea. They have worked very hard to manage the crisis. They have brought down their numbers. They are democratic, liberal, open, transparent societies. The difference has been that they have very strong state capacity. The leaders enjoy public trust. They came to very, you know, scientifically thought through decisions, and they were able to convince the public to comply. And it has a lot to do, obviously, with the fact that they experienced the SARS epidemic about 18 years ago. But still, clearly, there is not necessarily a tension between successfully galvanizing, motivating, organizing society and being a democracy. And I think that if we can take away one lesson from how Asia, in particular, these countries manage it, is that.
So how is life in Singapore right now? I know that it's not normal per se, but considering your proximity and travel to and from China, everybody in Singapore pretty much has to fly out of that country if you want to leave to go anywhere. It's remarkable how low the number of incidents and the number of deaths are there.
We are on, you know, something of a, you know, a lockdown, if you will. Schools are going to be closed. But again, it's a country that has, you know, fiber ubiquitous in every home. So, you know, kids will learn from school. You know, there is outdoor life, right? There is a lot of green space. You know, people can go to public parks and that kind of thing. Again, they've imposed social distancing very well. They have this cool app called Trace Together. Quite frankly, this is an interesting topic of discussion. If they had made it mandatory for everyone to download this app, then it could be that they would have traced even more cases than they have, but it's been voluntary. I actually think they should shift to a mandatory, you know, sort of requirement that people use this app. But that said, life is quite normal. There have been four deaths in the country, which is, you know, very low, but tragic. It's mostly been elderly people with pre-existing conditions. But they are, again, the communications, the messaging is so rock solid. It's very transparent. They ground it in the science and in where things are going right now. And therefore, it's very credible.
Describe how the app works and what level of information the government has. Are there any privacy concerns here?
Right. The Trace Together app is quite well constructed to address privacy concerns because technically the government has zero information. When you download the app, the app is on and it simply collects Bluetooth signals around who you've been near, but it's always on your phone and it never leaves your phone. And you could delete it or switch off the app at any time. If and when your phone number pops up on someone else's records who has been infected and the government's tracing team has accessed that person, I think you would probably agree that it's fair when you're, if you were infected and you're, you know, proven to have the virus, that you would voluntarily say, hey, you know, here, take look at my phone and see if I've infected anyone else. That's not exactly unfair. Then only would they trace those signals or access those signals and correlate it to, again, this anonymous ID number that's created by your mobile number. And then you can be contacted by the government, again, more or less anonymously saying, hey, we just want you to know that there is a patient. You were near him or her, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 days ago. We'd recommend that you exercise, you know, caution. But the government does not have your data. And, you know, there is a very ironclad sort of promise that as soon as this period is over, you know, you can you will get a message from the government saying, please delete this app. You know, please make sure that your data can in no way be compromised. This virus is over. Delete the app.
But when we go forward a little bit, what do you think the significant changes are going to be? I mean, because one of the things that this started to point out was our global interdependence, that our labor is not necessarily where our consumption is happening. And that's going to cause problems when something like this goes down.
Well, the consequences are going to be, you know, manifold. Economics is one of them. You know, reforms and more public investment, obviously, in healthcare systems is another one. I am forecasting that migration will be a significant one. And in Hari, you can definitely appreciate this. We are at a truly unique moment in history where there's a simultaneous global lockdown, if you will. You know, this sort of voluntary and involuntary reset of global demographics. There is zero net migration happening on the planet Earth right now. So imagine a hypothetical moment 6 months or 1 year from now where the world is declared virus-free. That's obviously not the way it's going to play out, but just imagine. We are going to witness a real-time experiment with people voting, where people will vote with their feet. And those who have lived through and been in a red zone and no longer have faith in that city, state, province, or country's capacity to protect them are going to be looking for other places to go if the other country is willing to take them. So we're going to see, you know, shift of populations, population transfer. We'll see countries that have labor shortages welcoming people. Now, that's obviously paradoxical because we're going to have very high unemployment. But as we know, migration is not a function necessarily of simply a country, you know, having low unemployment and therefore needing people. It's about skills. And right now, Hari, as I'm sure you've reported, U.S. embassies around the world are saying, if you have a medical degree, if you are a doctor, if you are a nurse, please come quickly to the nearest U.S. embassy. We're going to give you a visa and bring you to America. But we have record unemployment, right? So it's about skills mismatches. And we already have enormous skills mismatches in the world. And we're going to continue to have them once this lifts. So we're going to witness this real new experiment in the next phase of human migration.
How much of that migration also do you think is going to be motivated in part by, say, white collar workers around the world who figured out that I can do this job from home. Maybe I shouldn't be paying the rent that I'm paying in the city that I'm living in.
When you factor in the technological change and perhaps the comfort level that companies will have in terms of remote working, or even wanting to encourage remote working because it may be cheaper than renting commercial real estate, which is expensive. So not only will it potentially be encouraged by some companies, but the mobile talent who always wanted to telecommute more is now going to be able to say, I told you so. And, you know, let me keep on doing this. And maybe I won't have to do it from 10 miles or 15 miles from the office in an expensive city. But I think I'm going to go to Idaho or Wyoming or Bali, you know, or something like that. And I think we will see that because, you know, the reason I know we'll see it, Hari, is because that is exactly what has been happening. And now those people actually have a stronger hand in terms of their negotiations with their employers.
Does this change sort of global order of things? I mean, does it accelerate the end of U.S. dominance?
From the point of view of analyzing American foreign policy and America's image in the world, we wouldn't isolate it to just this event, though a lot of people will elevate this moment as a turning point. But let's remember that we have almost 20 years ago, the response to the 9/11 terrorist attacks, the failed wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the delegitimation of the American capitalist model because of the financial crisis, the partisanship and polarization that surrounded the 2016 election of Trump and so forth. So when you think about the image of America in the world and the perspectives about American leadership, it's been a fairly checkered story for a couple of decades now. But let's just talk about policies. You know, when you think about Asians, again, the leaders across Asia have been fairly blunt, you know, with American officials when they come through the region, which is that they're disappointed that the commitment to the alliance system, the demonstration of provision of shared resources and collective security has been wobbly. You know, the Trump administration has made these very, sort of strong and almost out of the blue demands for burden sharing financially in the alliance that, you know, these countries can't necessarily afford. Then there's the trade issue and so forth. So I think that, it's not about a change in leadership simply because we're more heading towards a leaderless world than a world where China replaces America. So I think it's a tricky question and a shifting target. We should not be looking, though, for two things. We should not be looking for China to become number one, because we're not moving into a world that wants there to be a number one. And we're certainly not, at the same time, going to have a world where America magically rebounds and becomes number one again. A, because that's not in our material capability to do so right now. It's certainly not even a bipartisan desire that exists in America. And let's remember, the rest of the world has also moved on. It doesn't want to follow anyone. You know, every country wants to, you know, be the pilot of its own plane and be in the driver's seat.
The interdependence that the United States has with China, the president has said we're too dependent on China. Does the U.S. have the resources necessary to bring all of these goods and services that we import from China back in-house to be less dependent?
Absolutely, it does. And, you know, this is one of the critical things why, you know, I don't want to write off or write down, you know, the U.S. even in a time like this, because if you geopolitics is not about the flavor of the month issue or how well or how badly you performed, you know, in one war or in response to one crisis. It's something much more sort of structural, fundamental. And if you think about the United States in particular, or North America in general, you've got, you know, 450 or 500 million people, so a very strong demographic base. You have all the natural resources you could ever want, right? You've got all the food, all the fuel, all the timber, everything, right? The bounty of nature that North America possesses. You have a very strong labor force. You have all of the financial capital and wealth, all of the technology and innovation. And the industrial capability is globalization and outsourcing and financial capitalism have been choices that American industry and American, you know, leaders and American companies have made. They aren't necessary. So America can nearshore on the back of having very cheap energy, having labor automation, having an abundant labor force. Everything from toys to semiconductors to medical devices can most definitely be made in the United States. It's hardly out of the realm of possibility. It's comical to think that there's anything in the world, quite frankly, that can't be made in the United States. You know, there have been episodes like the rare earth mineral export ban when China 10 years ago started to say, wait a minute, we've got this, you know, buried deep in the, you know, Earth's crust, we have these access to these rare earth minerals, and those components are necessary for mobile phones and other kinds of devices. And we're going to block the export of those things, you know, to Japan and other countries. And then the United States said, wait a minute, you know, we're buying them from you out of convenience. We have lots of rare earths too. And so does Mongolia, and so does Canada. And so that action that China took actually just reminded everyone of why they shouldn't depend on China.
Does it change China's dependence on the United States?
Well, China is actually much less dependent on the United States than people think. You know, for China, its dependence on America is measured in very, very functional kinds of, you know, materialistic kind of ways. So, for example, starting after 2015, when the U.S. Congress had ended the ban on exporting hydrocarbons, right? Once the shale oil revolution really kicked in, America had, you know, became one of the world's largest oil and gas producers. So China actually became one of the largest consumers of American oil and gas by 2016, 2017. Then came the trade war, and then China halted the imports of American oil and gas. China also buys lots of industrial goods and technologies from the U.S., but it has been trying at a breakneck pace to practice what I call permanent substitution. Right? How can you make inside China everything that you depend on others for, particularly if it's a sensitive technological area where you're worried that the Trump administration or any U.S. government will simply impose export controls on it? And that's obviously what's happened in a number of critical areas. So now Huawei has just come out with its latest phone model. It doesn't have any American components in it, either hardware or software. And it's a runaway success. So China is decreasing its dependence on the United States quite rapidly.
Are Americans willing to pay that price? And I say that two questions. One is, as the consumer and as the investor, if America was to become more self-sufficient and move all of its manufacturing locally, are American consumers willing to pay more for a t-shirt? Or are shareholders willing to pay more for the cost of production?
It's a fantastic question. I don't think there's a universal answer. It may depend sector by sector on what areas of industry the government is willing to subsidize or financially support. The shale industry did not take off simply based on capitalist logic, right? It had a lot to do with the incentives that the government you know, has provided for the oil and gas sector. The same thing could apply, obviously, to other areas like medical equipment, like technology and so forth. There's also a capitalist logic, which simply says, well, again, the input cost of energy is now very low in the United States because oil and gas are cheap. The cost of factory production is lower now because instead of employing humans, you can employ, you know, you can invest in robots. So there are a couple of conditions that are in place, again, for North American countries, particularly the US and Canada, to be able to make just about anything they want if they're willing to just invest in the robots. Investment used to be this very long-term proposition. Well, if I go and build an automobile plant, you know, in China or Thailand, this is a 40-year investment. But investment has become much more fungible, Hari. It means that, you know, it's like it's a sunk cost over there, but it doesn't cost as much as it used to build a new factory to produce something. The cost of doing that has come way, way down. So can we get the incentives aligned for the government to support the critical industries and those industries to find ways to service the domestic market profitably and at a lower cost of investment? Yeah, it's possible. So does that mean higher prices for consumers? Again, it depends on what the product is, but it doesn't have to be that much higher, quite frankly.
All right, Parag Khanna, thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure. Great to speak with you, Hari.
And finally, for something a little different, Rock and Roll Hall of Famer John Bon Jovi, best known for his hit Living on a Prayer, is enlisting fans to finish his new song by sharing their experiences of this crisis. To push his message out, he used a picture taken of him washing dishes and helping to prepare and feed those in need in his hometown, Red Bank, New Jersey. Like his Instagram post, the song is entitled Do What You Can. Take a quick listen.
When you can't do what you do what you can. This ain't my prayer, it's just a thought I'm wanting to send. Round here we bend but don't break, down here we all understand. You can't do what you do what you can. And you can't do what you do what you can.
Well, Bon Jovi's already received thousands of submissions as he and his family continue their three-week-long isolation. And he is joining me now from New Jersey, which, after New York, is the worst-affected state and has passed a rather grim milestone. As we speak, more than 1,000 people now have died because of coronavirus in your state. John Bon Jovi, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me, Christiane. Thank you.
So it's really bad everywhere. Everywhere you look, everybody is in this together. It's almost like the Great Leveler. Just tell me how it's affected, because I know one of your sons was showing symptoms. One of your band mates has recovered or certainly has tested positive for the coronavirus.
Yeah, it's affected everybody from all walks of life. It doesn't matter who you are or where you live. This is a worldwide pandemic, and we're all in this together. You know, as I was listening to the prior guest, it's the Great Leveler, right? And the world is going to change as a result. It did affect not one but two guys in the band. It affected my son, Jacob. His was a minor, mild case. It was intestinal, and it passed in 3 days. And fortunately, the rest of the household has stayed healthy. But everything has changed, and we've been here in isolation for 3 weeks now. And it looks like there's no end in sight.
Before we get on to the new song, I just want to know how you like to share the message to stay home. Because as we've said earlier on, there's still 8 states in the United States that don't have lockdown orders. People are still gathering in some of these places, are in very, very close proximity. And it's a real struggle in your state, in New York, to try to get control of this virus and protect lives.
It can't be any more real. You witness it by reading your newspaper, watching television news. Here in my town, the police had to come and break up a party with a band playing at it on Saturday night. It's just beyond comprehension that there are those who are just ignoring the will of local government and state-run government to say social distance, stay at home, do the right thing. Look, it doesn't matter if you're the host of a CNN news program or a guy that sings in a rock and roll band. We all can make a difference. By simply staying at home, you are affecting change directly. And so please, everyone, do their part. You know, and it's something as small as staying home is your contribution to mankind. Then please participate.
Well, look, that's very powerfully put. And you have now done this song. It's one of the ways you're participating. You've also, as we know, you're an activist and you do a lot to help, you know, people in need in your area. And you had this picture that you put out and asked people to do what you can. So tell me a little bit about how that came about, the verse that you wrote and what you've received from the fans who you're asking to contribute.
Thank you. As I said, we're all in this together. And as a songwriter, I thought of that title. The next day, I thought, there's a song. And so I sat down and I wrote the song in its entirety, all the verses, the bridge. I was finished. But I thought to myself, everyone is experiencing this differently and have a verse to contribute. So I put it out on social media and said, here is a verse. Here is the chorus. Tell me your story. Let us make this, you know, our story. And we've gotten thousands and thousands of people sending in verses or poetry or a letter, a video for the musicians who can play with me. And it's become this viral sensation because everybody, you know, has the same story to tell. We're living through this together.
Is there anything that strikes you as particularly poignant or particularly resilient from some of the verses that you're getting?
I think it's very similar here in stateside, especially. But there's a shout out and a spotlight on, of course, doctors, nurses, truckers, grocery store clerks, people who are living this life. And because the news cycle is 24/7 and everyone's got their TV news on, we're also making sure that we say thank you to the teacher and to the moms and dads who are doing their best and to the kids who are sitting home and being patient. So I'm getting a lot of those stories about, you know, people's lives.
John Bon Jovi, I don't know whether you've been struck and whether it compares to other disasters, but we've seen a lot of music come out of this, whether it's musicians like yourself doing something new and getting contributions, whether it's orchestras who are all separated and playing, you know, via Zoom, whether it's, you know, already sort of, you know, rock and rollers who are doing like quote unquote free concerts online. What do you think it is about this and about music that kind of collide and come together?
You know, in truth, music is the great healer. And at times like this, it brings people together and there aren't any borders or political affiliations. We all have some kind of draw towards some kind of music. It soothes, it heals, it helps. And at times like this, talk about globalization. You know, I've traveled the planet for nearly 40 years now. And songs like Living on a Prayer, It's My Life, and the big hits that I've had over the years, we've brought them to the planet. And so they share those commonalities and it brings cities together. You know, it brings countries together.
Now, you do have another charity and you've just released another song called Unbroken. And this is for wounded warriors. And you collaborated with Prince Harry on the Invictus Project. Tell me a little bit about that and why you were moved to do that. And of course, you know, that's all about wounded warriors who've gone out and put their lives on the line so that other Americans don't have to go fight wars.
When I wrote the song Unbroken, it was for an American documentary by the name of To Be of Service, and it was about servicemen and their service dogs, and it was a holistic approach to helping these guys heal. But on a parallel course, I thought to myself, Prince Harry has the Invictus Games, and I knew that they had a choir. And rather than my being the narrator in the song, I thought, who better to sing this song than the men and women who fought for their nation? So I sent it to him. It's not that I knew the gentleman, but I sent it to Harry. He responded, and before this pandemic became what it is today, we got together in London at Abbey Road Studios with members of that choir to sing the song, put it on record, and we were going to share it at the games with all the other nations and their soldiers. So again, you know, now it's suddenly I've written this album called 2020, and it's very topical, but who knew at the time that it was going to become this topical? You know, whether it was vets or the current administration in America or now the COVID crisis, I've written a whole entire record like this that someday everyone will hear. I'm going to have to delay the release, but such is life, you know, and it's just every day is an opportunity to write a song.
And it's something to wait for and something to look forward to. John Bon Jovi, thank you so much for joining us and for doing your part. That's it for tonight. And we let John Bon Jovi and the Invictus Games Choir play us out. An important reminder of the contribution that servicemen and women are making during this crisis as well, and how veterans do need support during this pandemic and beyond. Thank you for watching. Goodbye from London.
Someday you'll ask me, was it worth it to be of service in the end? Well, the blessing and the curse is, yeah, I'll do it all again.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
You can now watch CNN's Five Things on Max. Each weekday, Kate Baldwin breaks down the five essential news stories in 5 minutes or less. She'll get you up to speed and on with your day. CNN's Five Things with Kate Baldwin, streaming weekdays exclusively on Max.